Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A departure from Orthodoxy today, three guests. Two of them will talk about recent elections, Richard Seymour on Britain's and Trita Parsi on Iran's. And then we'll hear an excerpt from a 2017 interview with Jane McAlevey, the organizer and writer who died on July 7th. On first glance, Britain's Labour Party won a landslide victory in the parliamentary elections held on July 4th, winning almost two-thirds of the seats in Parliament. But a closer look reveals some cracks, like that huge majority came with just a third of the popular vote, thanks to the structure of Britain's electoral system. Here with more is Richard Seymour, a London-based writer and broadcaster and a founding editor of the darkly titled journal Salvage. His book, Disaster Nationalism, The Downfall of Liberal Civilization, will be published by Verso in October. Richard Seymour. Labour got roughly a third of the popular vote, but now holds two-thirds of the parliamentary seats. All this was done without US-style gerrymandering. What can we say about that disparity? What does it mean for their mandate? What does it mean for the electoral system? What do you think of that?
Well, it's crazy because certainly many of Starmer's defenders are anxious to say, no, this was, he played the game as it laid. This is an unfair system, maybe, but he fought for votes in seats where it counted. He wasn't too worried about piling up votes in irrelevant heartland constituencies that he knows are going to vote Labour anyway. The mandate is proved by his ability to get those seats. Now, there's a number of problems with that. First of all, that as far as I can tell, the increase in the Labour vote is not really concentrated in areas that you would expect, where there had been a small marginal difference between Labour and Tory. It's happening in places where you wouldn't expect, largely because the Tory vote collapsed. And actually, I think more fundamentally than collapse, split between the Conservative Party and Reform UK, which polled 14.3%. Compared to its previous incarnation, which was the UK Independence Party, roughly similar to what they polled in 2015, but a significant recovery for the British version of the far right. Qualify that, it's not a fascist party in any sense. It's a very bourgeois electoralist, but broadly speaking, within those terms, qualifies as far right. There wasn't a massive surge of sympathy for Starmer or enthusiasm for Labour. The polls showed that they were both pretty unpopular. Most people didn't really know what they stood for, what they were promising. And most people at the end of the day did not vote for them. Not only the majority of electors, you know, registered voters, either didn't turn out or certainly didn't vote Labour. I think it was less than a fifth voted Labour. When asked to name a policy that they can associate with Labour or Keir Starmer, most people couldn't do it. Even though they did have a few distinctive policies, it was a very badly fought campaign. And I think in general, this has to be put into the context that Keir Starmer is not, to my mind, a profoundly political person. He's a managerial type of person. Strategically, he's not very good, evidence of which when he's not benefiting from simple Tory collapse, for example, in by-elections in Hartlepool, in Rochdale, in Batley and Spen, and in Uxbridge, for example, he's done poorly. And his responses to defeat generally involve lurching further to the right. So, for example, after losing big time in Hartlepool, on the basis of a campaign which was like lager and flags, there was no policy at all. Having lost so badly there to the Tories, he then appointed a bunch of Blairite advisors to surround him and tell him more or less to keep doing what he was doing. And then one last aspect of this is that Keir Starmer went into this election having created numerous totally unnecessary crises for himself. One of them was, if you recall, that he ordered Labour front benchers not to attend picket lines during a big strike wave in 2022.
Just remarkable for a party with Labour in its name.
Yeah, it would have been going too far, perhaps, even for New Labour. I can't be entirely sure about that because there weren't huge strike waves at that time. But I think if cabinet members wanted to attend a picket line and build up support among their base, it would have been considered quite natural. But Starmer caused a kerfuffle, a crisis within the shadow cabinet. A lot of people disobeyed him. It looked bad from the media. It cost him in terms of his polling. More recently, as you'll recall, he was asked whether Israel had the right to impose a full siege on Gaza, water, electricity, food, fuel, etc. And his answer, after umming and ahhing a little bit, was they do have that right. He's prevaricated since, but in the interim between his essential non-apology, his denial that he'd said anything wrong, he had a number of Labour shadow cabinet members come out and defend precisely this line. Now, this coming from a supposed human rights lawyer, which was always a misnomer, he's a lawyer for the state, always has been, it was obviously very controversial and hurt Labour in its base. It then resulted in yet another crisis, because one of the measures that they brought about to try and rebuild support among the Muslim party membership and voters was a series of regional conferences where they would have MPs come in and like reassure them as to their bona fides on Palestine. In that context, one of their idiot MPs said a couple of things, one of which was definitely anti-Semitic and the other was verging on it, and so caused another stinker for Starmer, particularly because Starmer did not want to expel him. He'd been so keen to expel left-wingers who put a foot wrong, often who didn't do anything wrong, but he didn't want to expel him. So he's created crisis for himself, rifts at the top, resignations among councillors, resignations from the shadow cabinet, constant trouble with his backbench MPs, even before he's got elected. And he's walked into an election with a manifesto with small change in it. Tax and spending commitments amount to a sum total of 0.2% of GDP, which is miserly and indeed small change when it comes to government, and got elected on an agenda that scarcely anybody understands. He does not have a mandate. He has a majority. He doesn't have a mandate.
There is no substance on which you can build a mandate. It was basically a Tories out sentiment more than anything else, wasn't it?
I think fundamentally it was. It turns out to have been more fractal, if you like, than had been expected. I certainly didn't expect the Greens to get four seats, four pro-Gaza independents, pro-Palestine independents to get elected, Corbyn to be re-elected. Well, that's less surprising, but quite surprising is that in a number of seats where Labour should have been, these were not marginal seats, they should have been in with, without a problem. Wes Streeting, now the Health Secretary, his seat in Ilford North, I think, was almost taken from him by somebody called Leanne Mohammed, who was completely unknown beforehand, standing on a broadly leftish pro-Palestine slate. Nobody organized for her. We didn't even know that she was going to run him close. In Birmingham Yardley, a candidate for George Galloway's Workers Party, which is not of the left, it's a kind of diagonal formation, but pro-Palestine, while also being homophobic and various other things, almost took Jess Phillips' seat, which you know was a strong Labour seat, came very close. I mean, there was a number of instances like that. Even Keir Starmer's constituency, he has that constituency because it's a safe Labour seat. A pro-Palestine candidate, former member of the ANC, Andrew Feinstein, stood again with no hope and took a fifth of the vote and cut Starmer's majority down substantially. This was a lot more of a volatile situation and a situation much more reflecting generalized party breakdown and generalized detachment from the big political parties. And that has been completely disguised by a monstrously, aberrantly disproportionate electoral system, which obviously a lot of people are going to be thinking about, you know, how are we going to change that? But it does make Labour quite fragile because there are now a number of seats that it has that are obviously completely marginal and can be taken from it in a by-election or at the next election.
All right, let's talk about the fundamentals. The infrastructure of Britain and all basic services are all really seriously frayed. Mm-hmm. Can they fix this? They have any thoughts about how to fix it? Do they have the capacity to fix it?
They have some critique of neoliberalism. I think that's quite important, but they don't have any wherewithal or any willingness to fund it. Critically, they committed before the election to not raising taxes on any of the major sources of tax, like corporation tax. In fact, I think they want to cap corporation tax, higher income tax, taxes on inheritance, capital gains, that kind of thing. They also said they wouldn't raise VAT. Now, given that there is going to be a gap in their budget and they have to raise money, it's quite likely that they will either raise some tax on, say, capital gains, which would be the smart play because it would take the burden away from majority of people, or as the Treasury will urge them to do, they will raise tax on VAT, which is a very heavy sales tax. I don't know if you have a similar thing in the United States, and that will be wildly unpopular. The other thing that they have to offer, but they didn't tell anybody about this, is they've been in touch with a lot of asset management firms like BlackRock You may have noticed that Larry Fink, the boss of BlackRock, endorsed Starmer, called him Brave, you know, and has been publishing articles. He wrote an article in the Financial Times saying, you know, we, BlackRock and asset management firms in general, we're the source of growth, because if you need money for infrastructure and investment and you can't raise it by taxation, because we're not going to let you, sotto voce, you can come to us. We'll provide part of the investment. You give us the incentives, we'll invest in infrastructure. The only thing is, of course, they have to own it at the end of the day. And this would be not only a massive expansion of the old public-private partnership that New Labour pioneered in the early 2000s, and which was so devastatingly costly and caused a fiscal crisis for the NHS, but it would also be a merger between asset managers and the state. And I think this is really important. Brett Christopher's has written a sort of a quadrant of books, one of which is precisely about asset managers taking over the world, asset manager capitalism, essentially wherein there is these vehicles which are set up to take over infrastructure, housing, water, airports. BlackRock owns a number of infrastructures like that in the United Kingdom already, create such distance between the ownership and the day-to-day running, that essentially they just alight on an asset, squeeze it dry, move on. Very short-termist, no real interest in the asset itself, in the infrastructure. And it's quite a disastrous form of capitalist abstraction. And so I think that's probably the significant thing that Keir Starmer's Labour will do. And it would be quite contentious. I'm doubtful that they will raise sufficient money to get the kind of growth that they want. Apart from that, the only thing they have is changing the planning laws so that they can kickstart a round of construction in so-called brownfield sites. Again, the idea there is to increase the amount of available housing and thereby hopefully reduce prices. Don't think that's going to work. I don't think the problem in the UK housing market is that there is a deficit of houses per se, of accommodations. There is a need for building more houses, but fundamentally it's the houses that are built are unaffordable. They're built for a richer market, and house prices in the UK, as you know, are utterly crazy anyway. I mean, most people can't even get a ladder.
I'm speaking with the writer and broadcaster Richard Seymour. I saw a poll the other day saying that 71% of Brits say the country is worse off because of Brexit. Now, do you agree with that? And also, what do you think Starmer and company will do about the Brexit situation?
It's not a straightforward answer, this, because in some respects, the way in which Brexit has been done guaranteed that the country would be worse off. The deal that they wanted to negotiate was so unrealistic and based on such absurd negotiating tactics, premised on the idea of British global strength and premised on the idea that Britain could go off and negotiate trade deals with former Commonwealth countries like India, who were totally uninterested. And then, of course, premised on fundamentally on a sort of buccaneering form of free market capitalism. We call it free market, but that's not quite the reality. But anyway, the result was a kind of chaos. The result was that Britain lost markets without coming up with anything to replace it. There was an idea of a trade deal with Trump. Obviously, nobody wanted that. Britain doesn't have very much to export. We have a few industries, pharmaceuticals, arms and what have you, but not really very much. So the only thing that Britain has really and has had since the 1980s is that it's a multinational hub for foreign direct investment, for finance. It's been very effective at positioning itself in that way by creating a cheap labor market, flexible labor market, low tax regime, etc., since the 1980s. But now foreign direct investment is in decline. And that's why you're getting more of a statist, counter-neoliberal discourse, even from right-wing forces within the Labour Party. Brexit certainly could have been done differently. So, for example, it would have been possible to introduce some form of left populist version of Brexit. I don't think the balance of political forces was necessarily there to achieve that. But it would be worth thinking about what a Corbyn-led government might have been able to do, freed from European competition laws and all the rest of it, freed from restrictions on state aid. And certainly any government going forward will take advantage of those relative freedoms. So I don't think it's as straightforward as Brexit making things worse. Brexit also has a tendency to be blamed for things that are not about Brexit. So, for example, COVID had a much more devastating effect than Brexit in terms of the national economy. The subsequent supply chain squeeze had a much worse effect. And then there's also you know, apart from the economic effects, there's sort of political effects and the cultural effects. I think there's a general feeling that everything went a bit off the rails. The Conservative Party went to the far right, much farther to the right than probably at least half of its base is prepared to go. And the country's politics became more paranoid and brittle. So I think that there's a number of ways in which I think people perceive a decline. But my feeling is that Brexit was a stopping point on the road to decline, not primarily the cause of it, although the way it was handled did substantial damage.
Well, speaking from an empire in decline, there are many stopping points in the road of decline.
We're way ahead of you. You've got a lot further to...
Oh, yes. You pioneered that for us. Where is the Conservative Party now? From a distance, it looks like collapse. Where do you see the Conservative Party going from here?
Certainly, the first-past-the-post system disadvantaged them. So, for example, in the southwest of the country, they had a majority of the votes, but they had fewer seats than Labour. That suggests to me that if their vote recovers slightly, they'll retake a lot of seats. It's disaster territory, but it's not wipeout territory. Second of all, their overall direction is increasingly towards the harder and harder right. The Rishi Sunak period was a contradictory one in that Rishi Sunak took over from Liz Truss, who had just experienced the kind of institutional aggression towards a government that usually is faced by the left, and had been driven out of office after a radically misconceived mini-budget. And she was pretty hard on the anti-globalist right, to put it like that, drawn to conspiracy theories and all sorts of stuff about cultural Marxism. And Rishi Sunak took over and decided that he was going to basically revive Osborneite austerity economics. And so he appointed a bunch of Austerians, but he would try and supplement it with culture wars. And so Suella Braverman, who is about as far right as a Tory MP gets, and I think probably picks up a lot of her messaging from fascists, from actual fascists. For example, her speech today attacking trans rights and gay rights and the pride flag on the basis of allegations of children being mutilated in hospitals. This is a reference to surgery for trans people, which doesn't happen to children, by the way, in this country at all. So it was completely made up. But on the basis of that, launched a vitriolic attack on gay rights, on basically on LGBT and on the pride flag and on woke ideology, as she would no doubt put it. So that's where she's going, and that's where a lot of the Tories are going. And my hunch is that quite a lot of them will be looking to Farage and looking to see if they can form a reunion act, bring Farage and the Reform UK back into the Conservative fold on the basis of repivoting pretty hard to the right. I think the critical thing is that Rishi Sunak, he couldn't sell a culture wars agenda. First of all, he had no emotional connection to any group of voters. He was politically unstrategic and inane. He was relying upon unreliable allies like, for example, Braverman, Lee Anderson, both of whom got themselves sacked by saying things that just went a bit too far. And crucially, I think the anti-globalist right in the Conservative Party is predicated on a group of people who have been largely protected from the worst crises over the last decade or so, but they're not especially well off. They're not asset rich. Quite often they're retirees with maybe their main asset is their house, but they're relatively protected. And they don't have the same interests as the working class or anybody of working age necessarily. They don't have the same interests as those who've really been making a killing over the last decade or so, which is those who are asset rich. That's the Tory base. That's Tory members. And they vibe very strongly with Liz Truss's style of anti-globalist reaction. That's why a lot of them defected to Nigel Farage. And so I think Rishi Sunak couldn't sell that kind of politics because he was pushing good old-fashioned pro-city, pro-austerity kind of politics, and they wanted something more radical than that. That's where the Conservative Party is likely to end up going, further to the right. That's what the base wants. That's what would be the usual logic after a crushing defeat, that the grassroots gets revenge on the Tory establishment for the defeat they've just incurred. That resonates with an underlying trend among a minority of the British public, but a minority that often felt more influentially than it actually is. They have exaggerated salience in terms of their national media profile. Their concerns are talked up. They have institutional support in terms of major publications like the Daily Mail, the Daily Express, and so on. So they're punching substantially above their weight. I expect them to have, if they don't run the Conservative Party for the next 5 years, to have considerable clout in it. And I would expect them to act as a constant rightward pull on a Keir Starmer government that is all too willing to be pulled to the right.
We've been here many times before. A popular distaste for a right-wing government turns them out of office, only to be replaced by a tepid center-left that alienates and bores everyone. Obama, for example. Do you think this is where Starmer and the Labour Party are going?
Yeah, but I think it'll be far worse than Obama. I mean, Obama won 2 terms, very popular, very charismatic guy, didn't do much of what people wanted and created a lot of long-term rot, but he himself was very popular. Starmer is not. Starmer, actually, I think, will make himself hated very quickly. I mean, I already despise him, but that's because I know who he is. Most people have no idea what he's about. And I think as soon as people get exposed on a regular basis to that kind of greasy equivocation and to that voice that cuts through you like a dentist drill and to the sheer void at the heart of his politics, I think he'll be hated. But more fundamentally, to be honest with you, I'm quite apprehensive. Because I think all the instincts that have been displayed by Starmer and his allies are profoundly authoritarian. They lean into hard right panic about security and migration. They lean into racism. They lean into transphobia. That's already happened. They already said they're backing this so-called CAST review, which is essentially an assault on a version of trans healthcare. Every instinct on their part will guide them to do something appalling and atrocious that will make the country a lot worse. New Labour's version of that was the Iraq War. I don't know what it's going to be for Keir Starmer, but I know that he's hardline in his Atlanticism, desperate to cleave whichever way Washington cleaves, even if it's Trump in office, and so desperate to please the most reactionary forces in British politics that I would almost expect him to stumble into some sort of atrocity just because he thought it would make him look hard.
That was Richard Seymour, a London-based writer and broadcaster. He's got an article on this topic in Sidecar, the blog of New Left Review. And now on to another election, this one in Iran, for the presidency. The death of the previous occupant of that office, Ebrahim Raisi, in a helicopter crash in May led to early elections. The first round, held on June 28, produced no candidate with a majority, so a second round was held on July 5. The winner was Masoud Pezeshkian with 55% of the vote. He beat Saeed Jalili with 45%. Pezeshkian is described as a reformer and Jalili as a hardliner. What exactly do these labels mean, and what does this new president mean for Iran and its relations with the outside world? Here with some answers is Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute. Parsi was born in Iran, but his family left for Sweden when he was 4 to escape political repression. Trita Parsi. Westerners have these classification schemes, hardliner versus reformer, to characterize Iranian politics. How accurate are these? What do they mean in the Iranian context, or should we discard them?
They definitely carry a degree of truth. They can obviously be oversimplified. In the case of Pezeshkian, he is a reformer. He's not a hardliner. In the case of the current Speaker of Parliament, who was also a presidential candidate who lost, not the one in the second round, but who lost already in the first round, Ghalibaf, he's a conservative, but he's much more moderate on foreign policy as well as on domestic issues. So there's obviously a spectrum. If we just divide him into one or two groups, then that would be quite incorrect. Saeed Jalili, the guy who Pezeshkian defeated in the second round, is very much a hardliner in every sense of that word.
What are the significant differences? What makes one a reformer versus a hardliner?
Well, the reformers, first of all, recognize that the some of the original ideals of the revolution are no longer workable and things need to change. They prefer a much more open society, less restrictions on the population, far less restrictions socially, as well as politically. They have been promoting a strong civil society. In Iran, particularly during the Khatami years, it really took off, and believe that ultimately Iran will be more successful if it has a more democratic, more open society, that is more in harmony with the region as well as with the West, and believe very strongly that resolving Iran's tensions with the West is critical for Iran's political and economic development.
The president's room for maneuver is seriously constrained by the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, who is the official head of state and the final decision maker on most substantial matters. How much power does the president really have?
Well, the president in Iran is not in any way, shape, or form an insignificant character, but he is clearly less powerful than the supreme leader. But I would still emphasize, though, that individuals are oftentimes more important than the institutions that they hold. And in the case of Ahmadinejad, that was very clear, because Ahmadinejad was quite a strong personality, and he challenged a lot of the norms and oftentimes challenged the supreme leader. Towards the end of his presidency, he had a very bad relationship with the supreme leader. But other presidents, such as Raisi, was much more pliant, and as a result, did not play a significant role, was much more of an implementer rather than someone who was actually coming up with policy. It remains unclear, of course, what type of a president Pezeshkian will be, but as much as there are some structural restrictions, I would say that personality restrictions may be even more important.
The turnout was quite low. What does that mean?
It means that overall, the Iranian population is extremely unhappy with the regime, with the situation in the country, and have shown that by essentially not participating in the elections. If you take a look at the elections in 2017, when Rouhani was reelected, participation was 73%. It's been all the way above 80% in some elections. In this past election, in the first round, only 39.9% participated. That's the lowest yet in the Islamic Republic. In the second round, that went up to about 50%, and that seems to very much have been because the choice was so stark between Pezeshkian and the ultra-hardliner Jalili. And that appears to have pushed several people to a significant people, 25% more, to go to the polls. But overall, it's very clear the population has never been happy with the regime, but now this is an expression of an unhappiness with the idea that change can come through the ballot box.
Apologies, there is a technical glitch here that caused the first 5 seconds of Tritaparti's answer to get lost. My question was, relations with the West are obviously very important. What are your thoughts on where those might go under Pezeshkian? Parsi began his answer by noting, in the part that got lost in the ether, that while the nuclear agreement that restricted Iran's weapons development, the so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, was in effect from 2015 to 18, Iran was in contact with the West. His audio resumes with him talking about what happened after Trump pulled out of that agreement.
Of course, the Iranians did talk directly to the U.S., and they continued to do so as long as the U.S. was in the deal. But once the United States under Trump pulled out of the deal, the Iranian position was that they would only talk to the U.S. once it returned to the agreement. Now, Pezeshkian is saying that that's not serving Iran's interest and that they should have direct talks with the U.S. and resolve the tensions and get a new nuclear agreement. That's going to be extremely difficult because a lot of things have changed. And perhaps the old JCPOA cannot be revived, but there's still a prospect for a smaller one. And in my view, if they really want to resolve the tensions, they should go for a much bigger one. But that requires a president in the United States that is willing to prioritize this issue and pay the political cost and the spend the political capital to get that deal. And the same thing on the Iranian side. Pezeshkian seems to indicate that he does have that. It remains to be seen whether the next American president will have that.
How friendly exactly is Biden to Iran? Would that be that much difference with Trump?
I mean, there obviously would be a significant difference with Trump. But I would say that Biden's main issue is that he has not seen this as that important of an issue. He has prioritized getting normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel over everything else in the Middle East. And he has not really spent the political capital to get this deal. He could have gone straight back into the deal when he became president. He chose not to. Instead, he worked for the first 10 weeks to try to make sure that the Israelis would be okay with some variation of the JCPOA, which was an impossible task, and anyone from the Obama team could have made that clear to him. In fact, some of them did. But Biden was never willing to pay the political cost for getting a new deal. And that's part of the reason why we don't have a JCPOA right now. Whether he will be different in the second term remains to be seen. But I think we have to also be very clear. Back when Obama was doing this, Iran was the top national security issue for the United States, rightly or wrongly. Today, it's really difficult to say that Iran should be a higher priority than Ukraine, than Taiwan, than Gaza. So I think it's going to be difficult to get the next American president to prioritize the issue to get a new deal. It might be sufficient to prioritize the issue to avoid an escalation, but that's different from actually getting real constructive diplomacy towards resolving the conflict.
Israel's war in Gaza, how does this fit into the picture and support for Hamas and Hezbollah? What do you expect a new president will do for those things?
No, I don't see the president of Iran changing the position in terms of supporting Hezbollah or its relationship with Hamas. That's not an area where the president will have much of an influence. But even if he did, I don't think that that is the direction Pezeshkian will take it. This is not an Iranian president that is trying to be America's best friend and as a result do whatever the U.S. wants it to do. The Iranians view their relationship with Hezbollah as a very critical one. It's the strongest alliance that they have. It's also the longest alliance that's been held in the Middle East. And it's, in their view, their first line of defense against what they think may end up being Israeli aggression towards Iran. So the idea that they would just change that to please the United States is outside of the realm of possibility.
Sometimes it seems like Netanyahu really wants a war with Iran. What do you think of that?
I don't think it just seems like that. It's a clear track record of 20 years of Israel pushing under Netanyahu, but also under other prime ministers, pushing the United States to go to war with Iran. Whether he wants to have his own war with Iran, I think, is a different story. It's only valuable to him, I think, if he believes that it will force the United States into that war. From his perspective, from the outset, he wants to have a rebalancing of the power balance in the region, which means that he wants to significantly weaken and cut Iran down in size. It's not just a nuclear program. It's Iran's conventional military power, its relationship with groups such as Hezbollah, etc., that the Israelis are having their eyes on. In many ways, this is, at the core of it, a geopolitical rivalry that exists between the two sides. It is fueled by ideology and political preferences, of course, but it's not the core reason why there is an enmity currently between Iran and Israel.
How would the U.S. view a war with Iran?
I think it's been very clear. Four presidents, Bush told the Israelis that he didn't want to see a war with Iran by the Israelis. Obama was very clear on that point. Even Trump at one point told Netanyahu, I think he was a bit frustrated that Netanyahu was trying to push the U.S. to attack Iran. He said, if you want to have a war with Iran, why don't you start it yourself? And Biden, I think we also saw very clearly in April when there was an exchange of fire between Israel and Iran after the Israelis struck the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus, that he actually, for the first time, put some real pressure on the Israelis not to start a wider war with Iran. So I think the preference is very clear from American presidents, Republican or Democrats, that ultimately war with Iran would be disastrous for the United States.
And what about domestic policies? The economy is a mess. Inflation rate is 38% last I looked. How much of that is from the sanctions? How much of it is from general corruption and mismanagement? And would a new president be able to do much about that?
All of the factors you mentioned are very critical in explaining the economic mess in Iran. Corruption, mismanagement is critical, but so are sanctions. Iran has had the same corruption and mismanagement before without suffering the way that it does right now. The difference is the intensity of the sanctions. Sanctions also tend to fuel corruption. Incidentally, that's a phenomenon we've seen in almost every country that has been under long-term sanctions. The president can address a lot of these issues, but it's also very clear, even if you fix corruption and mismanagement, you will still have significant problems because of the sanctions. The Iranians have been able to increase their trade, but trade is not enough. They need investments, and investments they cannot get unless U.S. sanctions are lifted. They cannot get U.S. sanctions lifted unless they have direct dialogue with the United States and actually seek to either resolve the nuclear issue and the many other problems they have with the U.S., or at least try to mitigate them.
I imagine there's some pretty powerful people in Iran who are making a lot of money off the current arrangements. They might not have an incentive to do much serious economic reform, would they?
Absolutely. There's clearly strong elements in Iran who are making a killing out of these sanctions. They've actually been called out, not only by Pezeshkian, but also by the previous president, Rouhani, who accused them of not wanting to see the nuclear issue resolved because they were making so much money off of the smuggling that comes as a result of the sanctions being imposed. And then, as I mentioned earlier on, the smuggling then fuels corruption, and it just creates a very deep illness in the economy. Addressing all of that without addressing U.S.-Iran relations is next to impossible, and it's part of the reason why Pezeshkian made it a priority to restart talks with the United States.
And finally, the current regime's been in place for, about 45 years. It's getting pretty old. What are the prospects for its longevity? Do you think it's a stable thing, or is it going to face some serious changes in the coming years?
Two things are true. One is that for more than 45 years, people in Washington have predicted that the regime is going to fall within the next 18 months, and they've always been wrong. But it is also true that at some point they're going to be right. This is not likely going to be a regime that is going to be able to last forever. But right now, it has really dug in its heels. Despite significant challenges and problems, it is not facing an acute existential threat from within. It is having massive problems, undoubtedly. Its legitimacy is in the trash can, but it's still in power. And unfortunately, one thing that we have seen with states that are under embargo-like sanctions for a long period of time, instead of changing and certainly instead of democratizing, they tend to become more restrictive, more authoritarian, more adventurous in their foreign policy, and more problematic in general.
I was Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Lost in these violent times, I forgot people could be so kind in these violent times. Dollar signs, almost lost to chasing dollar signs. Know the cost, but I forgot the price. Bye.
That was some of Violent Times by St. Vincent from her newish album, All Born Screaming. And now, a memorial. Jane McAlevey, the organizer, writer, and human dynamo, who appeared in this show 10 times over the years, starting in 2012, died on Sunday, July 7th, at the age of 59. Way too young. I met Jane over 20 years ago and loved and admired her enormously. The word tireless is a bit of a cliche, but she was exactly that. I feel the loss personally, since we were real-life friends, but those feelings pale next to the loss to the workers' movement. Jane had been fighting multiple myeloma for some time with the same fervor she brought to organizing workers, but the disease proved a more formidable opponent than the employers she fought for over 25 years. She was most famous for working with nurses and teachers in the U.S., but she had a worldwide influence through her books and consulting work. She was full of ideas developed through practice on how to organize unions, which she saw as essential to making this a better society. Among those ideas, organize to win rather than make symbolic points. Make sure you have very strong support for strikes and other militant actions. Don't start something you can't carry through. Understand the larger power structures that workers and their employers operate in. Involve workers in negotiations and don't just treat them like extras in your play. Identify the natural leaders of a workforce you're trying to organize and focus on enlisting them in the cause. If you want to learn more about Jane's career and philosophy, check out her books, like Raising Expectations and Raising Hell from 2012 and No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age from 2016. To memorialize her, here's some of an interview from March 2017 talking about some of the themes from No Shortcuts, notably real organizing versus fake organizing. Jane McAlevey. You make a very useful distinction among three approaches to political organization or political activity we can talk about. One is an advocacy model, one is a mobilization model, and the third is organizing, the one that you're really interested in. But tell us about this model, this unholy trinity of political action.
Yeah, sure. First of all, yeah, it's great to be here. It's always good to talk to you, Doug, and to be on your show. So advocacy, mobilizing, and organizing. Yeah, advocacy, which I think really developed into a dominant model in this country starting in the early 1970s, is essentially, you could say it's the Nader groups, it's something like Greenpeace. It's where a group of people, generally well-educated, full-time staff, you know, are paid money by someone to advocate for a cause on behalf of the cause or those affected by it. So that's advocacy.
If I want to put a class angle on this, it's as if the professional or a portion of the professional managerial class is hired to do work on behalf of the downtrodden.
Yes, for sure. And by the way, there is a class analysis to it, right? And I mean, interestingly, I quote Theda Skocpol's book, Diminished Democracy, in the very beginning of No Shortcuts, because she actually did some interesting analysis. I mean, she sort of, I didn't realize until I was reading that book of hers, that she also called out the idea that there was this explosion of sort of, you know, working class kids who went off to college in the 1960s because of what happened with the GI Bill in the 1940s with vets coming home. So we have an explosion of the number of what we used to call the working class kids who went off to college in the 1960s, who sort of discover, you know, the world. And they came out of college and the anti-war movement sort of thinking that they were really wicked smart, smarter, it turned out, than the ordinary working class. And they move into and set up this whole infrastructure of advocacy organizations. And they begin to think, hey, you know, we just need some money and we can sort of make sure that the laws that we passed in the 30s through the 60s, from clean air to Social Security to Medicaid and all that stuff, you know, we can, all we have to do is just go enforce them. And we can do that with some lawyers and some full-time do-gooders working for organizations. And we don't really need that messy thing called trade unions anymore. So that's, I think, the origins of the advocacy model in terms of it being something that came into the quote unquote progressive movement, have their origins in that moment. By the mid-1990s or the post-Reagan moments, some people are beginning to realize, you know, it turns out it's not good enough just to have, you know, a bunch of well-trained lawyers and liberals in full-time staff positions in Washington advocating for, quote-unquote, on our behalf to get press and, you know, to be taken more seriously. We actually have to have some ordinary people involved. The big argument in the book is that we evolved a sort of new model, which is called the mobilizing model. And that's what I'm trying to call out as super problematic today. And as part of the reason why we're in the mess we're in 2017, is because it used to be that people understood there was advocacy, lawyers, liberals, full-time staff working on behalf of others. That's sort of the do-gooder advocacy model. And then we thought there was organizing. And anyone who wasn't doing advocacy was doing organizing, which meant people were involved. We're actually relying on ordinary people to get involved, take action, do direct action. And what I'm pointing out in the book is that it's an illusion, and that actually what's happened is something called the creation of a mobilizing model. And in the mobilizing model, it actually still is full-time, college-educated, professional staff who are actually the key agents for change. It's just that in the mobilizing model, they understand that to create a good Twitter feed or a good narrative, or if someone's going to testify at the legislature, it turns out it's more effective if the testimony is actually delivered by one of the poor and downtrodden, if you like.
Human props.
Yeah, it's people as props. So in the mobilizing model, like, the theory of power isn't any different than in the advocacy approach. The theory of power is just an elite theory of power where elite do-gooders can go out and get the work done. It's just that workers become props. They involve some people. Who they're involving is sort of what I call the activist core. Those people who are already super committed to the campaign that we're trying to win. But what they're not doing is actually enabling and empowering the masses of ordinary people to themselves learn that the only salvation is themselves. So in the organizing model, the theory of power is a class struggle theory of power. The idea of the 1% versus the 99% has become like a passe slogan. It's like saying democracy or something these days, right? Like, sure, we're all for the 99%. First of all, we're not. Second of all, the question is, how do the 99%, or as I like to say, more like practically speaking, about 80%, how is it that the 80% of the masses actually become involved? They only become involved in a serious way when they're actually leading their own struggles. And so in the organizing model, the theory of power is actually quite different. It's not an elite theory of power. The theory of power is about the millions of people in this country who are taking it in the neck and losing everything right now, themselves have to be empowered and skilled and trained to stand up and fight for themselves. The biggest challenge is that people haven't understood that there's this thing called mobilizing going on, because everyone who's doing mobilizing says they're doing organizing. And the whole point of the new book is to say, no, you're not. And that's part of why we're in the giant mess that we're in today.
What you call the mobilizing model, it sounds a lot like the Fight for 15.
Well, sure. Absolutely. I mean, that's pretty much on a good day. I mean, some days it's just the advocacy model, honestly. And other days in other states, it functions mostly like a mobilizing model. And, you know, I've been known to be fairly critical of how the Fight for 15 campaign is being waged, and I haven't changed my opinion about that. But I do want to say it takes us to another segue, thinking about the Fight for 15 campaign, which is absolutely a mobilizing model, right? It's people as props. There are not right now thousands of low-wage workers making any decision, and how anything in that campaign is happening. That's not who's making the decision. A handful of elite staff have always been making the key decisions, along with a couple of big PR firms, and who are therefore the central lead actors in that campaign, with a lot of hardworking, ordinary people serving as props. There's a limitation to the idea that the fast food campaign should be the center of all of our attention to begin with, which is the whole idea that there are strategic sectors that we have to be organizing in to challenge capitalism effectively. I'm partly arguing, while it's good that people get raises, and that's important, and of course it'd be idiotic to say it's not good that people get raises, if we want to go at the power structure of this country, we have to think carefully about which sectors of workers have the most capacity to build the kind of power that we need to build to actually challenge capital. And I hate to say that as good as it feels to do the Fight for 15 campaign, it's not the most important strategic sectors that we need to be organizing in. And that's part of the limitation of the whole campaign.
The focus on fast food workers sort of feeds into an attitude among philanthropists and, you know, elite do-gooders, professional do-gooders, that they're most interested in the weakest, poorest, most marginalized sectors of society. And actual power frightens them, I think. That target fits in. Now, they're not really looking to challenge the order. They're just doing to do a little old-fashioned upper-class uplift work.
Yeah, 100%. Bingo. Absolutely. That's exactly right. The philanthropic elite wouldn't be interested in challenging capital. It's an oxymoron, right? I mean, you wouldn't be in the philanthropic sector.
No, they'd be committing class suicide if they did that.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, as complicated as the trade union movement is, there isn't any day of the week when I wouldn't personally prefer to be being funded by the ordinary dues of hardworking workers who have made the decision to pay them. At least in a system where people are paying dues in theory, right, when workers themselves are actually paying dues and paying the salary of the folks who they hire, at least in theory, we understand the capacity is there to seriously challenge power and capital because it is the masses of the workers paying the bills.
Okay, and in contrast to these two deficient models, you propose organizing as the real way to go. Everyone will point out that we're not in the world of giant factories anymore and big industrial towns, and it's really hard to organize in an environment dominated by precarity and marginalization of the working class. You don't really buy that argument.
No, I don't buy that argument. The same people who want us to get stuck in a do-gooder model of advocating on behalf of the poorest, most downtrodden, weakest sectors of our society are also the people who sort of throw out the same argument, right? That there's really nothing to be done here. In the 1930s, when we had a smart left building a serious trade union movement, we had strategic sectors. They were not actually just organizing willy-nilly. They weren't going to the buggy whip factory and organizing the buggy whip workers in the 1930s, right? That wasn't the theory. In today's economy, there are a whole bunch of strategic sectors where workers themselves still can hold power, where workers can still use the most powerful weapon that workers have, which is called the strike. There are still workers using the strike, and we need to be focused. Power building needs to happen in the sectors of the U.S. economy where workers still can have real agency, can still shut down the workplace and or do what I call creating a serious crisis for capital.
When you talk about organizing workers like this, you're going to hear someone say, but worker is just one part of a person's identity. People live multiple lives in their communities, and this old-style organizing isn't really adequate to the way people live. That's anything but accurate critique of your work, but explain why it's not.
I think in the 1930s, we understood, the left leadership inside the trade union movements understood the same thing that those of us still winning today understand, which is that workers are not just workers. They are whole people. They have complicated, interesting lives. But the point of good organizing is to help make connections. It's to enable people to see that if they connect up all the various points of oppression in their lives right now, gentrification, they're getting kicked out of their housing. They had a decent apartment with stable rent for years. Suddenly the gentrifiers are coming to take their neighborhood. It turns out, as I say in No Shortcuts, it turns out that when you start to explain to people that the CEO that they're fighting in their hospital fight is on the board of the Philadelphia, in the case of Philadelphia, is sitting on the board of the Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation, which is where Wells Fargo, of all godforsaken banks, is coming in to finance the gentrification of their neighborhood, that their CEO is connected. When you help workers start to make the fundamental connections that the CEO they're fighting in the workplace is also responsible for the bad things happening in their kids' schools and in their neighborhood in terms of getting kicked out of their apartment complex, which is going to be demolished for some high rent, studio apartments. People begin to get enabled into the fight in a different way. They come to start to realize they actually have to build a working class movement again to take control, not just of the workplace, but also of their neighborhood, their schools, and their city and their country. And when we help workers make those connections, that's what organizing is about, helping people understand and see the connections between their third shift and the gentrifier coming into their neighborhood. They begin to fight differently. And I can tell you great stories from being in Philadelphia last year.
Alas, we don't have time for those. That was Jane McAlevey, the organizer and writer who died on July 7th, from an interview first broadcast in March 2017. I'd say rest in peace, Jane, but that wasn't really her style. For a list of all my interviews with Jane McAlevey, visit my blog at lbo-news.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out this Sum of Power by Gudrun Gut and Myra Davies for their 1993 collaboration, Miasma. Till next week, bye.
Power. Let's talk about power. Power in the home, power on the phone, power at the office. Power at the table, power in the stable, power at the corner store, power with the man next door, power on the bus, power on the street, power in the bedroom. Let's talk about power. It's everywhere. We're always talking about power. Even when we're not talking about power, we're talking about power. Everybody wants it. Beauty is power. You can't take the power out of beauty. And you can't take the beauty out of power. It's at the base. Power fills the space between you and me.